Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
As I told a couple people, I said, you probably should be able to make sure you can get out your snowshoes if you want to get off the trail, which has not been the norm.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about deep snow on the Iditarod Trail. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get too bogged down in the details, how about a word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod 2020 comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media, and I'm joined by Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon and Zachariah Hughes. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hello, I am Tegan Hanlon.
And I'm Zach Hughes.
Perfect.
Nailed it.
Very good.
So we're recording this on Friday, the eve of the 2020 Iditarod. Today, we're going to talk about what to expect this year as much as we can expect anything. The known knowns, the known unknowns, not so much about the unknown unknowns. Zach will be heading out on the trail soon. We know that much, in a plane that we hope will take off and land and fly safely. Tegan will be working the gears and levers that make our Iditarod coverage run on our website, alaskapublic.org. And probably the biggest news since our last pod is that Jeff King, the four-time champion who's run the Iditarod 30 times, has dropped out due to a medical emergency. Zach, what happened?
Well, he dropped out right after our last pod, which was live. If you haven't listened to it, you can. It's in your app. But we hosted a live event, and Jeff King was one of the mushers who joined us on stage. It was about 90 minutes. Everything went really well. It was great. And then the next morning, Jeff was set to come in on Talk of Alaska, a public affairs show at Alaska Public Media, and he texted our news director to let her know he was not going to be able to be there. And what came out was that he had had to have emergency surgery. So that was a surprise. And it turns out that he'd been having some stomach cramps earlier that day. And as he was driving down from his homestead out along the Parks Highway, he said he got terrible stomach cramps that morning. He wondered if it was something he ate, something that might have been in his smoothie. He even called poison control at one point and asked if perhaps the fresh ginger in his smoothie might be contributing to his cramps. They said no, and I talked with him the next day about the whole thing. So this is what he said about early on in the day before the program started.
Going into Anchorage, I felt almost normal again and thought, surely it has passed.
So Jeff comes in, meets with us. Everything seems to be going okay. He sort of mentions he's feeling a little bit off to Tegan, but for the most part, you know, he's lively telling stories on stage. And
during the program, I was uncomfortable, but not debilitated.
So it wasn't until later that night that something started to really feel amiss. Jeff was staying with longtime friends who were both healthcare professionals, their doctors. They did sort of an informal check on him on the couch at their house. And he said pretty quickly they realized that he needed to go to the ER.
Only to be met by autograph seekers who recognized me.
Somebody was taking his information and at one point sort of looked up and said, like, wait, you're that Jeff King? And eventually a doctor who saw him said, hey, I think I know what this is. I think it's a hernia. They tried to get it back in. Jeff said it was super painful. They gave him some morphine. They were able to get it back in. And immediately he said he started feeling better. There was still pain, but he was still very much in the mindset of this is a speed bump, but I'm going to keep going and this sucks. They took a CAT scan just to be careful and find out what was going on. This whole time while people are looking at it, Jeff's thinking of, you know, his race and what this means for it. And then eventually he gets news that the CAT scan caught something nobody was really expecting.
I still thought, wow, maybe I just wear a belt that holds this spot and I'm back on the trail because I felt pretty good. Shortly, a surgeon walked in and said, I'm one of the three people that just looked at your CAT scan. And your problem is very serious, that your mortality rate is going down 10% with every 8 hours. And we need you to get into surgery tonight.
So it turned out Jeff had a perforated intestine. That's a tear or a hole in your gastrointestinal tract, which can cause sepsis. It can cause all manner of things. And as he was told and passed along to me, it could have gotten really, 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 really bad. And he was rushed into surgery. It went well, but he told me they still had to remove like 10 inches of his intestines through this giant 7-inch incision ending at his belly button on his chest. And at that point, it sort of became clear he was not going to be competing in this year's Iditarod. In fact, he's got about a 3 to 6 month projected recovery. So everything's going well. He was doing interviews with media the next day from his hospital bed and sounded okay. He sounded really grateful that it had been caught, because if he'd just been sitting at home, you know, there's a clinic that's sort of nearby to where his homestead is, but it's about 2.5 hours or so to get to medical care in Fairbanks. It's another, what, 4 to 6 hours, depending on road conditions, to get from there to Anchorage. And, you know, early in the day, he thought it was indigestion or maybe something he ate. And he said that he probably wouldn't have gone to get medical care. And it was actually kind of a good thing that he was in Anchorage.
So I'm not sure I would have gone to any doctor until later. And man, I'm really glad I didn't wait.
Jeff, in pulling out, still had a fully ready team in good working order. He had drop bags and supplies across the entire route coming up. I mean, we were within a week of the Iditarod starting. So even though he's not able to be there, his entire apparatus and the thing that his kennel is built around training for, the Iditarod, was all still in place. So Jeff asked the board, hey, I have this handler who works for me. He finished his qualifiers this year. He was planning on running next year. I want him to go in my stead. I want him to run my team. And as it was told to me, that's an unprecedented position to be in. Somebody who's never run the race before, filling in for a veteran and just taking their team wholesale. But the Iditarod Trail Committee's board of directors said, yep, the rookie knows the team. He has qualified. He knows what he's doing. We'll allow it. And so now 28-year-old Sean Underwood from Georgia, who's been handling for King for a couple of years and has run his team a lot, is in the position of getting like 4 or 5 days notice that he's going to be running this year's Iditarod.
It's like dad is handing him the keys to the hot rod, right?
It's like the Lamborghini is what he's driving to Nome, it feels like.
Pretty interesting storyline, you know, developing in this year's Iditarod.
I think it'll be interesting to see what Sean can do with, by all accounts, probably this 4-star sled dog team. He mentioned that he's not planning to really run a competitive race, but it'll be interesting to see what happens when you have a musher thrust into a 1,000-mile competition at the last minute. So we'll see. I'm excited to see what Zach finds out on the trail.
These mushers talk about kind of what their plan going into it is, or what their like different plans are, but then they start looking around and seeing what other people are doing and how their dog team is performing. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see kind of what he does with the Lamborghini when he's actually in the race, right?
Yeah, and he's run these dogs plenty. He's intimately familiar with him. It's not like he's never gotten into the Lamborghini before, but he sort of jokingly said to me when I talked with him on the phone on Tuesday night, like, you know, I've run 300-mile races, but not sure what I'm going to do after 300 miles. And I mean, that's a fair thing. It's, you know, it's a much larger scale than what he's prepared for and what he's done. And, you know, I told him, Sean, I've never mushed the Iditarod, but I've heard from a lot of mushers that, you know, the best thing to do after you hit 300 miles is to keep going the other 700 miles.
That's good advice.
So. Yeah. Thank you. Been having a lot of fun with the potential headlines around
yes.
it. Filling in for a king.
Underwood, no longer underdog. Better.
So that's one storyline in this year's Iditarod. Another one is the trail itself. It's always something the mushers and reporters and everybody else on the race talk about and think about at length. Tegan, you did some reporting on this. There's been a little bit of snow, eh?
There has been a little bit of snow, eh? Yes. So Zach and I were talking to Iditarod race director Mark Nordman earlier this week, and I asked him what one word he would use to describe the 2020 Iditarod trail, and he said patience. And that's because of the deep snow that he says covers most of the trail to Nome this year.
It's going to be a discussion amongst mushers, you know, just how they're going to deal with it. And as I told a couple people, I said, you probably should be able to make sure you can get out your snowshoes if you want to get off the trail, which has not been the norm.
Mark actually shared some photos with us while we were talking to them, and one of them showed one of the members of the Iditarod trail crew. He had gotten off of his snow machine, stepped in the snow to the side, and was chest deep in powder. So that kind of exhibits just how deep the snow is on either side of the trail. I thought one analogy Mark Nordman gave that was interesting was he said it's kind of like if you get 6 feet of snow and you have to shovel a path to your house is kind of what they're doing right now to get the trail ready for Iditarod mushers.
It's like a, like you said, a trench or sort of like if you're in a hamster maze and there's like the walls on either side of you. So, I mean, there's this issue of like if you get off the trail to camp or something, you're going to need your snowshoes to be able to walk around in that deep snow. Presumably there's going to be this trail or trench or whatever for the teams to be actually passing through. But what does that mean about sort of how fast the sleds can go?
That's a good question. You know, we asked Mark that earlier this week, and it sounds like, you know, for some teams, it'll probably be a slow race. What Mark seemed to think was that there are these top teams that are so trained up and so competitive and nothing really stops them anymore. So he didn't think that it would be a big factor for the top teams. Will it mean something more for the middle pack or those in the back? Maybe. Maybe we'll see a slower race to Nome.
With that much snow, you know, any sort of wind event or extra precipitation that comes could totally scramble what progress has been made on the trail. What Nordman said and what my pilot, when I talked with him yesterday, had said was snow machine crews have just been going back and forth between some of the sections on the north side of the range heading up to Ruby on the Yukon, just trying to pack down snow and firm up that trail, keep it defined. But you don't need a lot of snow or a wind event that could just cave some of those caverns in or scramble stuff. And then even if it's just areas of kind of washed out trail, if you're imagine being the first musher to encounter that, whether you're at the front of the pack or the middle of the pack after a wind event or a storm or something like that, it might as well be no trail and you're dealing with feet of snow. So we'll see. It's very different from past years where I feel like in advance of the race, we've been relaying information from the Iditarod about which sections had no snow or, you know, all the ice bridges that they had to build through the gorge or just areas where it was really bare that they were making accommodations for. And this year it's quite the opposite, it sounds like.
And we were talking a little bit about that, too, in terms of temperatures. There, you know, temperatures are kind of below freezing across the trail. And last year, at least, we were dealing with rain. I was in Shagaluk and there was mushers coming in ponchos, in rain jackets. And Travis Beals, I remember he had taken a trash bag and poked his arms through the sides and turned it into a rain jacket.
It's like there's always something, and I think that's just the nature of this race.
One thing I was thinking about last night was it'll be interesting to see how the deep snow impacts musher strategies in terms of carrying dogs. We kind of saw Mitch Seavey really successfully use that strategy in 2017. He would, you know, put dogs in a sled or in this like contraption in the back of his sled. It was like, you know, a coach would switch out players on a bench, and he could do that because the trail was hard and fast. And I think with this, it'll be interesting to see what they deploy or their strategies in this deep snow, presumably slower trail where you need more power to move.
I'm also going to be curious about how they rest off trail. I mean, that was a thing that Mark had mentioned too, is a lot of the times in between checkpoints, whether for substantial, you know, 4 or 5 hours rest, mushers might kind of make a little kind of bare bones camp or even just pull the team over to snack the dogs. I mean, if you are running in a canyon trail, getting the team off and then maybe like stomping down kind of a flattened out area for them to chill out, I would assume that just takes a little bit longer, involves more kind of logistics. We'll see whether mushers are more reticent to do that because it takes more time. I'm not really sure. And the other thing is passing. Passing is going to be interesting. You've got to coordinate. You always have to coordinate. There's rules for how you pass along the trail, but we've had a lot of snow in Anchorage here this year, so I think listeners here might be familiar with that experience of it's a two-lane street, but there's so much snow piled up on the side that you and the oncoming car sort of like, maybe you go first and I'll just kind of drive up onto the snowbank so you can get by and then I'll go.
There's a negotiation that has to happen there.
Yeah, so with here, I mean, there's going to be a little bit of a negotiation that the trails that the snow machines make are not super wide. I think Nordman quoted us at with the groomers and some of the wide tracks they're using around 42 inches, something like that. So that's under 4 feet, driving 14 dogs to try and get around your companion who's also got a sled and 14 dogs. I'll be interested to hear about that. And moose.
That's the other thing, right? There's this sort of this pathway there for the moose, and they don't want to have to walk through the deep snow either. So moose tend to, when there's deep snow, get on that easier path. And the Iditarod is kind of unique in some ways in that you are allowed to carry a gun for this very reason, because it's happened before. Moose have been on the trail. They will stomp a dog team, and it could end your race. The Anchorage Daily News actually reported on this, Aubrey Weber, just recently, and brought up some of these past incidents. Aaron Burmeister had this problem one time, and a moose got into his team and beat him up pretty badly, and he's actually going to be carrying a .44 Magnum, apparently, according to the ADN. Susan Butcher had to scratch one year because of some injuries to dogs from a moose attack. Apparently, in the 1993 Yukon Quest, this musher by the name of Jeff Mann, he killed a moose with an axe during one of these attacks, which I had never heard about. And I wish there's just this one line in the ADN story about it. So I kind of want to know more about, like, you know, what happened there. I shouldn't laugh, but it's like, that sounds crazy.
Yeah, I think if you are unfamiliar with some of Alaska law, there's a state rule called DLP, Defense of Life and Property, where you can terminate game, you can shoot them if it's in defense of life and property. That would include your own life or the life of your property, a sled dog team. So you are expected to be able to take care of your team on the Iditarod. And some mushers will bring flare guns. They'll bring loud sounds to scare off the animals. It's pretty dramatic. And I would be curious to hear if in Iditarod history, anyone's had to actually fire a live gun at a moose. But it's written into the rules of the Iditarod that if you do shoot a moose, all the mushers who come up behind you have to help you salvage and responsibly remove it. You're not allowed to just shoot it and keep racing. You have to responsibly process the game meat. So this is something that, particularly this time of year, this is a time of year, this kind of pre-spring breakup, end of winter, called the starvation period in some accounts, because the animals don't have a lot to eat. They've burned through their fat reserves. Animals like moose that don't want to expend energy walking through deep snow will use game trails, snow machine trails, whatever, to conserve energy and get to food wherever they can. So it is a variable to be contended with, and this year it might be a little bit more vivid.
It's kind of an amazing scene to think about a musher parking his or her dog team to salvage this moose, joined by potentially one, two, three other mushers behind him or her, all stopping to salvage game.
Yeah,
it's like an interesting picture.
It's written into the race rules. So, if you've ever looked at the rules, you kind of can picture this scene happening.
And it's not just moose out on the trail. I mean, the buffalo tunnels are so named because they are tunnels that have been largely put in by a herd of bison. I can tell you that Pilot Rob knows where the bison are this year, because he just got back from a bison
be eating
trip.
On this trip.
We will be stopping in Rome to pick up some bison meat he left in a cooler at his camp.
Just real quick, another thing that the Iditarod is looking out for is the coronavirus that everybody's talking about and worrying about, probably for good reason. We got this press release from them, yesterday or the day before, about whether or not your dog, or the dogs, I guess, in the Iditarod can get the coronavirus. And apparently they can, but they can't transmit it to humans. I think, you know, it's hard to tell what is real with this whole thing in general, but I guess that's something that they're talking about. And, you know, the Iditarod always kind of has to deal with food sanitation when you have people coming into checkpoints and, you know, sort of eating from all the same food sources. And we were in Caltag one time, and they had spoons for, like, picking snacks up out of the bowls that were on the table. And I asked one of the race officials, like, why is that? And he's like, well, people get real sick. You know, people could get food poisoning, basically, if you're just, like, reaching your hand and everybody's doing that. So they're well aware of these kind of issues. But, Tegan, you asked Mark Nordman about the coronavirus implications, right?
I did, yeah. After we talked about all of the snow on the trail, we also talked about the coronavirus. And he said they're taking it really seriously. They're in tight communication with the state of Alaska to talk about guidance. There's a lot of people traveling to Alaska for this event. Hundreds of volunteers, mushers from out of state, mushers from out of country, and then they're traveling through rural Alaska. So he said they're upping their sanitation at race checkpoints and also kind of distributing the, you know, typical literature that we're seeing everywhere in terms of how to avoid getting sick or avoid getting the coronavirus in this case. Washing hands, not touching your face.
Can I ask, have you guys ever gotten sick when you've been out on the trail during Iditarod?
I mean, other than a cold, no. How about you?
No, I haven't either, thankfully. Have you?
Yeah, I feel like I've gotten like a bad cold, like probably the majority of times I've
sleep deprived and cold.
At least twice. Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's the sleep deprivation. I think since I started like taking better care of sleeping and eating, it's been better. But yeah, I'll be extra careful this year because I've gotten burned in the past.
Well, I've seen people get burned in the past, and I think I've maybe told this story before, but this might be a good time to tell it again. Right after we left Caltag in that race, right after they explained to us why they use spoons to get the M&Ms out of the bowl or whatever to prevent people from getting food poisoning, we're flying along in a helicopter. My recollection is we were at like 1,500 feet or something, heading from Caltag to Unalakleet, and the pilot says to ADN photographer Bob Hollinen and I'm going to have to put it down. And we kind of, there was just this like pause and we like looked at each other, Bob and I, and he goes, yeah, like I'm going to have to make an emergency landing right here. And it was just like tundra out there. And this whole time we're just like flying around in a helicopter and I'm like looking up at the rotors thinking like, oh, that's all that's holding us up in the air, you know, and I had kind of gotten over that fear at that point. But of course, when the pilot says, I'm going to have to make an emergency landing, it kind of comes back, you know.
Turns out the only things holding you up were the rotor and your pilot's bowels.
Exactly. Yeah. So he lands on the tundra, makes a perfectly safe, normal landing, flips some switches or whatever to like start to shut the helicopter down, but like not fully. And then he like gets out and just sort of throws himself on the tundra and starts throwing up. And it just happened to be that the Iditarod insider guys were like 100 yards away.
You know, oh my gosh.
You think there's like nobody around, you know, like nobody's going to see
Man,
this.
And those guys are everywhere.
They are. These are the videographers that shoot video for Iditarod.com, the Iditarod insider programming. And he like gets done throwing up. He comes back to the helicopter and like does whatever, you know, flips switches or whatever to actually like shut the helicopter down. Cause he just told Bob and I just sit here, everything will be okay. And then had to go sort of find a stand of like bushes or trees or something to kind of go deal with the rest of his food poisoning in private. And the Iditarod insider guys come over and they're like, what's wrong? We saw him throwing up. Is he drunk or something? Like, no, it's like food poisoning or something. And this poor guy, he was a great pilot, but he was just suffering from then on, like dehydration. Every checkpoint that we went to, the first thing he did was go lay down somewhere, and that's basically all he could do. He couldn't really eat very much, and he toughed it out, you know? And I guess at that point, we were kind of concerned, like, was he going to be too dehydrated or whatever to fly the helicopter? That all worked out, but yeah, I've seen it happen, you know? Speaking of eating, the banquet where the Iditarod bushers pick their start order happened last night. They pick these numbers pretty much at random. That's the start order that they will have when they leave. The official start Sunday in Willow. Guys, how would someone's start order affect their race going forward?
Particularly in the beginning, I think that's where it really matters once strategy and rest haven't begun to play. If you're way out front, you might be breaking trail for the other teams. If you're a little further back, you might have a smoother trail and a lot more scent on it for your dogs to follow and get excited. So you might be making better run times. And this year, I wouldn't want to be the first musher out of the gate. In fact, this year it's a rookie who's right out of the gate. And so that's for the first part.
I would think it's also, if it's a really soft trail, it's probably not the best to be all the way in the back, just in case it's super chopped up with all of those little dog paws running on it and the sled runners. I don't think I would want to be at the tail end of that.
Mushers riding the drag on the beginning, yeah, trying to keep their teams from going too fast.
And snow machiners. I mean, that's a huge complaint among mushers, is in a lot of these places, a lot of the exact same trail that the mushers are using is also being used by everybody else that's transiting the area. And that might be recreational snow machiners just out to cruise around. That might be the Iditarod insider guys on those big fat Scandics that they ride. I think the Iditarod Trail Invitational is wrapped up, but in past years, there's also, you know, fat bikers and skiers also along that trail. And so if you're in the back, you know, you're contending with a trail that has been pulverized and in some snow conditions can get really soft, can get really choppy, doesn't hold its shape as much. It starts to get really punchy and beaten up and holy, and dogs are working a lot harder and they risk injuries. So your order on some of the snow conditions really can have a big impact.
There's like any sort of hole in that snow is a potential pitfall for a dog's paw to go in, and they can hurt their legs. And You know, we're talking about moose, and they talk about moose holes and Ooh. How a moose's legs will punch deep down into like soft snow and leave this booby trap basically for the dog's legs to get hurt in. And then, yeah, if you've ever tried to drive a heavy snow machine up a hill and you're not going fast enough, it just digs a huge trench down into that snow, and it'll make it real hard for the next guy coming along to try to get up the hill.
Do you want to just say, I mean, in this year's race, there's 57 mushers competing. That's bigger than last year, but is a smaller field, particularly in the last decade or two, where we've seen, you know, mushers signed up in the 80s and even 90s on some of those years. There's 12 rookies in that field, which that seems about normal in what I remember. Of that full field, 14 are women. That's not the hugest proportion that I've seen, but well within the kind of normal range. And there's four different countries represented outside of the U.S. There's a bunch of Canadians. There's one Italian. Denmark's there. There's multiple Norwegians. Nicolas Petit lists his hometown as Girdwood, not as France, but he comes from France. So I don't know if you want to count that or not. And Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, a lot of questions still, obviously, about the 2020 Iditarod, which is, as we're recording this here, Friday, kicks off tomorrow in downtown Anchorage with the ceremonial start. Takes off officially from Willow on Sunday at 2 p.m. A lot of questions, but not so many to us. We are still trying to get our listeners to send us questions. We love it if you record your questions for the mushers or for the reporters or basically anybody else using your voice memo app. All iPhones have them. Most other smartphones have them. You just open up that voice memo app, record yourself asking the question, tell us your name, tell us where you are, and send that to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. That's iditarod@alaskapublic.org. We like to mix it up. We like to have different voices on the show, and that's a really good way to get on the Iditapod. We like to have you guys here, too, with these different voices. Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon and Zachariah Hughes. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails. All right. Welcome to the Iditapod.
A doodly doo.
I think we've gotten the willies out. Let's see. It's a podcast about fear and loathing and friendship on the...
Well, it's about the Iditarod, but the undertones, yeah, fear, loathing, and friendship.
Okay. Really, I do like that theme, you know.
Well, you were
last year's
in store for some great swag.
What was last year's?
Fun and friendship.
Fun and friendship.
Ah, much more lively.
Yeah, a little more upbeat.
Things have changed.
Yeah.
Can I say what I wanted this year's theme to be?
You could say whatever you want.
I wanted it to be gratitude and glee. But Casey, thought that was bad.
I was in a bad mood, so yeah.
What about snow and smiles?
Snow and smiles. We can try out a few different themes.
I will report back from Nome whether there are smiles after all the deep snow.
Yeah, upside down smiles.
True.
Fear and frowns.
Fear and frownship.
Frownship. Okay, let's do this. Welcome to the. Let me try that again. I am your dictator, Casey Grove. Not
it
always
is me,
benevolent.
El Papa Grove.
Don't wake Daddy. Okay, quiet on the set, please.